coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Thank you for listening to Lutheran Radio UK, and welcome back to our weekly survey of the Bible lessons for each Sunday of the church year. I am Jamie Krieger, your host, and I am joined by David Weber and Ethan Stoppenhagen. We are currently going through Series B of the three-year series lectionary, and on today's episode we will look at the lessons for the ninth Sunday after Pentecost. And they are Jeremiah 23 verses 1 to 6, Psalm 23, Ephesians 2 verses 11 to 22, and the Gospel according to Mark chapter 6 verses 30 to 44. We begin with Ethan Stoppenhagen, followed by comments and questions from David Weber.
The feeding of the 5,000 is a well-known pericope, but today our gospel lesson sort of sets it in a broader context. The disciples have just returned from their preaching tour, and they fill Jesus in, and then Jesus tells them to go away and rest in a desolate or a wilderness place. Now, the hinge moment, I think, that you have with this text is between the disciples' return and rest and the feeding of the 5,000. They hop in the boat and they go off to the desolate place, and Jesus comes ashore and he sees all of the crowds that have followed him and the disciples into the wilderness, and we're told that he saw the crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd, and he began to teach them many things. So here we learn something about Jesus' compassion and how for Jesus a compassionate response is teaching. Now in most cases, usually if someone is suffering or down and out in a bad situation, you're not going to sit down and lecture them. That would just be received as come across as patronizing. But Jesus here, he sees them as sheep without a shepherd and has compassion and sits down and teaches.
How disappointing that would be if I was in the crowd.
Right, exactly.
Especially I'm a little bit hungry right now.
Right, because he's going to do this. He's going to lecture all day then. And, then they're not going to eat until the sun is set. So I guess what do we make of this? Like how can we begin to see Jesus teaching and preaching as a compassionate activity? Do you have any first thoughts on that, David?
Well, my first thoughts is it might be able to be desired. I'm not sure if I would ever am that good of a person to ever desire teaching before eating. Mm-hmm. I really have a fondness for eating, especially when I'm hungry.
Right.
But I don't think you could lecture somebody and say what you ought to do is recognize that teaching is more important than eating. I don't think, I could imagine someone trying to do that, but it would be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. The body is far more present as a reality, especially the body in need, than the mind is. And so I think eventually, at times in our life, we actually do come to the realization that the teaching is far more important than the material feeding. I think Mark actually will tell us, here's how he came to believe this really kind of ridiculous or unbelievable truth. So this is what I'm waiting to hear from you. How would I really believe that the teaching is far more important than my material comfort?
I think it's in the response of the crowds. They follow Jesus. I don't think they follow him around the lake because they know he'll feed them. I think they follow him because they know that his teaching gives life. In the midst of the chaos, because that's where the scene starts, is chaos. Many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. That something about Jesus teaching enters into the chaos and creates order.
There have been some few moments in my life where I was occupied with other things and forgot to eat. So I think this isn't just a throwaway line that Mark has, is it that the presence of Jesus at actually was fixating in a way that they forgot that they were hungry and tired. I don't know what to do with that, but I just think that that's offering out what happens when this hard to trust truth presents itself.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that's not the regular order of things, right? The regular order of things is like you said, that there is this, you know, this union between eating and teaching, that you're feeding the soul just as much as you're feeding your body. You do it at the same time. So, you know, and that's, you know, I don't know where else, how much deeper to dive, except that there's something about Jesus' teaching that the crowds recognize gives life, and that they have the recognition that this is, that the teaching does actually have more importance than the food.
I used to teach a course in bioethics, and one of the big distinctions is between body and soul, right?
Mm-hmm.
Christian bioethics and what we do certain things not because it damages the body, or we don't do certain things because it damages the soul. But quite frankly, that doesn't have any currency in the world, because the body is all important and the soul is mythological. And this text, I think, offers the preacher a good opportunity to say, look at this, is we are so counter to the culture we live in,
right?
Because we are trying to recognize the truth that it is the soul, that we're both body and soul, but it is the soul that will outlast the body. It is the soul that should be fed first. And what I like about this is it recognizes that to come to that truth is never going to be easy so long as we're in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So is this, I mean, the way you're presenting it, it sounds very promising that Christ really does intend to show us the priority and superiority of the life of the soul.
With that, you know, and it doesn't just stop there. It's that Jesus creates, as he goes into the feeding of the 5,000, he creates a setting that allows the ongoing life of the Spirit, because he comes in, you know, they're captivated by him. The crowds are captivated by Jesus all day, and then all of a sudden it's evening and they need to be fed. And so he sits them down, so they gather what food they have, the five loaves and two fish, and they sit down in groups on the green grass, and it's in groups by hundreds and by fifties. It's almost like he's forming little congregations that these little groups they're not little, but they're groups that form like a core nucleus of where this activity of this compassionate teaching and learning is going to continue.
That's a tremendous promise. Oh my gosh. I mean, that somehow what's happening here spiritually then, you know, comes back physically. So yes, they have a spiritual hunger, but that spiritual hunger is getting them to congregate. And presumably when they're congregating, they're conversing. And, you know, we keep talking about all the problems of modern day loneliness. The reason why people are so lonely is that we don't have dining spaces anymore. You don't meet regularly to eat together. You seem to be saying that right here, when Jesus is going to do his best spiritual work, it becomes very physical. People are getting together. These hungry bodies are being organized in a way that will at least solve that problem of loneliness.
How can we see our preaching as an act of compassion that sort of does this gathering activity? And if we look at it as an act of compassion, how might that change how we preach and teach?
My first impression is that our teaching, because we've been commanded to do it, not because mm-hmm. we can do it like Jesus, is a part of this gaining momentum in which the soul takes priority over the physical. I mean, if we go with what you had said initially, that they were hungry and yet Jesus delayed that hunger, he deepened the hunger, the physical hunger, by teaching. And And his greatest gift then he passes on by telling us to give to the people his greatest gift. But I don't think any of us are God's gift to our people. I mean, we talk weekly about how we wish we could imagine doing it better, but it just, for all the work we put into it, it just doesn't do what we thought it had the power to do. Because we can just scrape the surface. And I'm babbling on here because I really like the idea, this last thing, that somehow Jesus commissions us to carry on this very good work. And again, I can just see the disappointment in God's people. Say, no, no, we'd rather have you do it, not him.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, and I guess that's why we meet regularly. You know, you said how we fail so often to even scratch the surface. That's why we gather in our hundreds and fifties or tens and twenties each week to just keep scratching the surface. And maybe as we scratch the surface a little bit more, we might actually start to get somewhere.
Well, and I know we're under time limit here, but that whole thing of it was revelational to me that God's truth is cumulative. It seems like in the Bible, the big splash is always avoided. Jesus running away from crowds. Jesus not entrusting himself to the powerful, right? It's rather that he would prefer the slow accumulation that happens interpersonally. That's how love actually works.
And the Psalm sort of picks up that progressive accumulation of the truth, I think. And it really does put the gospel lesson, it takes the gospel lesson and puts it into poetry. And it's really, it's the prayer of the sheep. You know, Jesus looked at them, had compassion, and as because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And Psalm 23 is the prayer of that sheep. The sheep that has received the compassionate teaching of the shepherd. And so they've foregone all things, right? They've recognized that even their earthly hunger doesn't matter, right? I shall not want. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul, leads me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. You know, these are all phrases that we carry closely in our hearts, but you have in them this idea of the shepherd leading a sheep. It's not just that we're stagnant. And I think the key phrase here when it comes to that teaching is the rod and the staff, which are those tools of discipline. But the psalmist says, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So there's even in the recognition that even if the teaching is hard and it's difficult to grasp and really makes life troublesome, it nonetheless gives life and can bring comfort, because the rod and the staff is a sign of Christ's presence in that teaching, even in the valley of the shadow of death. Because that's, I think we forget that, is that the only reason a sheep ends up in the valley of the shadow of death is because the shepherd has led him there. You know, we could say he's wandered there, but I think it's more deliberate than that, that Christ leads us into those difficult places, into the places of suffering, so that he can use his rod and his staff to teach us. So it's not always just green pastures and fish and loaves. There's also a sense of discipline and rigor as well to this activity. And then still in the midst of it, you have the table being set, right? Even in the midst of the enemies, in the midst of the valley, the table is set, our head is anointed, and we become kings, right? And we have the goodness and mercy of the Lord and all his riches bestowed on us. But it's all, as you say, it's progressive. It's a slow trod through life.
Do you have an idea how this one poem could be that people insist on it at the funerals?
I do feel like the psalm is over spiritualized. You know, we're talking about the physical reality that that the gospel gives us, and I think the psalm in many ways just sort of, you know, he restores my soul, and my soul is all that I am, essentially. And he's going to see me across. He's going to shepherd me across death into heaven. I mean, you can have a very physical reading of this text that, that sort of acknowledges that the needs that we have in the body just as much as we are being fed in the soul.
Maybe one of the reasons people want this read is that it does give credit to the importance of the body. Even though the body is dead, mm-hmm. it was in the body that all these revelations took place. The body is not meaningless. The life is not superfluous. The physical is not somehow unreal. It's all very real because at the death of the body, the great revelation takes place about how we have always desired a mercy that lasts forever. And at death, that's where we come back to the baptismal font, where we find that mercy is the most important thing that's set upon us. And it, you know, and baptism is very physical. It's placed upon the body. But here, so rather than seeing death as an unraveling, it's a fulfilling. It's a revealing. Maybe that's what the psalm is, why it's such comfort to people at the time of mourning and death.
Yeah, it's looking back and seeing the whole journey that you've been on, and how the Lord's hand has been, you know, active, not just in some spiritual way, but really in a sacramental way. Turning then to Jeremiah, we sort of have more shepherd imagery. You know, we get this throughout all at least the first three readings, and what we have here is the Lord condemning the shepherds who destroy and scatter the sheep of the pasture. So those who I would say are the false teachers who lead people away from the flock, away from Christ, and who failed to educate their flocks properly. And I say that, and I remember, you know, the word educate means to lead through. And so we as preachers are always tasked with leading our people through, leading them to see the truth and the light of Christ. But there are these false prophets who have driven them away and not attended to the flock. And they will be justly condemned. But the Lord nonetheless is the great shepherd. You know, even if we become one of those shepherds who scatter the sheep by our preaching, the Lord still gathers the remnant together and sets new shepherds over them. Shepherds who will care for them, who will ensure that there is no fear, that there is no dismay, and that none is missing. So again, you have this idea of unity coming out of the midst of the chaos.
Here's what strikes me. This passage treats shepherds as all important to the spiritual life of people.
Mm-hmm.
Nowhere in my daily life is my role as a pastor considered at all important.
That's the great, you know, it's not great, but one of the more difficult things about our vocation is that there is this sense, I mean, we recognize, or at least we tell ourselves, we recognize this great importance to our task.
Oh, I don't think we do. I think that's why clergy burnout is what they keep talking about. Now, maybe that's just a problem we've created, right? But don't you find a lot of pastors just kind of discontent with being a pastor? It doesn't seem to be relevant or important or useful or however we judge value.
Well, it depends on, I guess, what you're measuring your ministry against. You know, if you're measuring it against, you know, the standards of the world, which are going to judge you based on numbers and influence and events, then I think it's very easy that you could feel that pressure and be pushed to burnout. But, you know, if you're standard is the biblical standard, you know, the what Paul's going to talk about, you know, that the church being built up in Christ on the foundation of the apostles and the prophets, as long as you're doing that, there's still the room for burnout, but at least there's confidence in what you're doing.
Well, okay. Tell me what Paul says, and that maybe the epistle will answer how we do an important task when it's culturally marginalized.
Interesting. You know, culturally marginalized, as Paul's talking about bringing in the Gentiles into the body of Christ. But ultimately, what it comes down to is the fact that we are built together. We're all members of the household of God, built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, with Christ himself as the cornerstone. So what I think there you have is that to be built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets is to be built on their teaching, right? Which is just the word that they have received from Christ. And that has just been passed down. So it's continually relevant. That word has been transmitted throughout the generations. And even when the church seems culturally irrelevant, it is always relevant to Christ, in whom the whole church is joined together and becomes a holy temple and his dwelling place.
So you don't find that people are just maybe at times bored with what they do in church and wish they would have done something more useful?
Oh, I have no doubt about that. You know, I don't know if our task then is revealing the life that we have in this.
I think it's passing out the bread. You know, and no one ever says my life was changed by that meal that I had on June 6, 19, you know. food doesn't work that way. Food works that you get it and you forget it. If our work in extending Christ's teaching is that, then I think it's going to be frustrating. We're going to wonder, you know, we spend an awful lot of time preparing and cleaning up, and the eating is so small and it rarely gets thanked. So if that's the metaphor for what we do, I can understand my earlier questions, right? It's tiring to do this, especially because feeding doesn't have the big, great moments that we think it should have. And yet, you know, from the biblical point of view, that is what's sustaining life. That's what's sustaining souls. It's not going to get recognition, but it is still the most important factor, this ongoing feeding. So,
right. Not just in the Eucharist, but also in the feeding of the Word, right? Jesus is the bread of life and the Word. But it's never going to be as impressive as the feeding of the 5,000. It's going to be rather monotonous, quiet, and you know, it's going to be a small group of people, those groups of hundreds and fifties, who get together each week, and a lot of them will probably wonder each week, why are we doing this again?
Why are we doing? Yeah, I'm very much attracted to it, that Paul said that when Jesus died, he broke down the wall of hostility. Right? Mm-hmm. And that work carries on, that there's something about the work of the church that is continually to break down the walls of hostility. Now,
right.
I've been looking at religious leaders and reading about them, and it seems that they are fomenting hostility. Mm-hmm. What's going on in our modern world, do you think? We seem to be missing Paul's message here that whatever Jesus did, it was aimed at defusing hostility or somehow reconciling it. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, well, it seems that the emphasis today is heightening our distinctives, right? As whatever, you know, whatever church body you're a part of. And by raising awareness of those distinctives, it actually generates more hostility. And puts up the dividing walls, rather than addressing those differences in that small community gathering, right? I guess what I'm trying to say is that we don't have the ability to speak to one another. And so when that ability has been lost, then all we're going to do is emphasize that which makes us distinct and use that then as our ammo against everyone who is not like us.
That helps me with the other passages and just saying that here is, if you look at the world as an essentially hostile place, the way that you undermine is not being more hostile, but you serve dinner and you right. talk to each other and you gather around, you know, what we say is a cliche word in sacrament, but it's far more than, it has more, much more energy than a cliche when it's done repeatedly. So that really does help bring things together for me.
That really then is then how we're built up into Christ. It's not just that, you know, we have the right teaching. It's that we are gathered together and we are discussing that teaching, and so that and gathering around the table so that we're finally going to sort of rise up into that dwelling place for the Holy Spirit.
Thank you, David and Ethan, and thank you for listening. All the podcasts from this series, Worth Doing Badly, are available from our website, lutheranradio.co.uk. Try our app. Download it for free from Google Play or the App Store. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other program on our schedule, send me an email to manager@lutheranradio.co.uk. I am your host, Jamie Krieger, and I will be back next week with David and Ethan. Thank you again for listening, and stay on for more here on Lutheran Radio UK.